reminded me of one way that I think about attunement, which is, it became clear to me 15 years ago when I read autobiography that that we're all eventually going to be saints and masters.
Exactly.
Someday.
Exactly.
And just naturally, some people are further ahead on that, and
yeah.
The ones that are all the way ahead just don't happen to be on this earth anymore. They're off somewhere else.
But, right.
If we're getting there anyway, we might as well get there sooner.
Well,
you might as well get to bliss sooner than slower if you have a choice.
If you have a choice.
And so, if you have something that you want to be, why not try and be like
yes.
the saints and masters that you do have available to you?
So. That's exactly right. Swamiji said it to us once. We had this beautiful satsang at his house many years ago, very, very deep. And at the end of it, he just looked out from wherever it is that his consciousness is, and he said, "You're going to all get it right sooner or later. Why waste a few million years?" And that was just, he just looked at us. That's sort of what he felt. He could see that the divinity was perfect within us. Why mess around with all these other things? Why not just go straight to Satchitananda? Why spend all this time proving to ourselves that this isn't it, this isn't it, this isn't it? Just cut all that and just go. And see, that's why the presence of a master, either in embodied form or within yourself, does just cut you all through that, because all of a sudden, oh my gosh, this is so delicious, and you don't have to discipline yourself then not to.
Maybe it has to come to what you said before, like the basics of like a like the bliss itself, you know, was poor because he had nothing to share with, you know, like what he was about. So it's like maybe it's like learning to share, you know,
yes.
in all the levels
yes.
of consciousness, you know, from like the very basics to like, you know, like what you're saying, you know,
yes.
higher masters, sharing everything that we can collect with the real happiness to the ones next to us.
That, you know, that Alfonso, you haven't yet been to our Sunday service. Everybody else here has. We have a ritual at that service, which is called the Festival of Light. Just, you know, slight resemblance to the Mass, but not really. But there's this allegory in the middle of it, which is the story about a little bird. And the story of the little bird is exactly what you just said. The whole progress of that bird through its evolution is first being selfish, then gradually learning to share. And then the fourth and last stage of the soul's long journey is to be a master and to live entirely and only for the sake of others. And that is the destiny that all of us must follow exactly right. And that is the gradual expansion of consciousness. Okay, we're talking about attunement. I mean, all this is about attunement, but we're talking about attunement. Attunement is the gradual expansion of your consciousness to embrace the welfare of everyone within your sphere, just the gradual expansion. We are bound together by bonds of mutual service. And because we are all Satchitananda, it is our responsibility. And what we gradually learn on more and more profound levels what it is we have to share and how to share it. And that's what the masters teach. First we feed hungry people, you know, then we gradually learn that uplifting their consciousness is the real solution. And we just progress through all these different levels of sharing. Just Alfonso said it exactly right, from the more material until the more subtle. And we do that because it's the nature of bliss to share itself, and the more bliss we have, the more we want to share it. So the whole teaching of Jesus, to use it as an example, of the entire focus of Jesus' life has become the crucifixion, and not merely the crucifixion, but how just horribly he suffered and how much he was mistreated and how fortunate we are that he was so willing to suffer, and we have to be willing to suffer. I mean, I just don't find that very magnetic. And it's also not true. Jesus didn't suffer. Jesus gave himself for the cause. And the cause in his particular time and place was he had to create, because of the age he lived in, this extraordinarily dramatic story. It was a very, very gross time. And the Jews, by their own definition in the Bible, are a stiff-necked people, and they don't learn easily. And so it was a very extremely forceful confrontation and a very forceful lesson that he gave, both of his own courage, of his willing to stand by the truth as he saw it, his willingness to die, because that was his belief, and then his transcendence of death. But it wasn't his suffering, it was his courage and his transcendence. That's the message. I went to, with Swamiji, we were in Florence and we went to the Uffizi and we went through and saw, you know, there's so much beautiful religious art there in the big museum in Florence, and a tremendous, tremendous number of depictions of the crucifixion in all different ways. And we came out of that and Swami said, well, he said, I think we're ready for a new theme. You know, just the world is ready for a new theme. I think we've done that one really well. I think we should just wipe that one off. And in our Festival of Light, we say, whereas in the past, suffering and sorrow was the coin of man's redemption, for us now, that payment has been exchanged for calm acceptance and joy. So rather than even imagining that the process of growth is through suffering, which is a fundamental tenet of Christianity and Catholicism, we're ready for a new theme. If Satchitananda is our true nature, that's what we're going for. It's the transcendence. And let us focus on the transcendence. And yes, we may find it's a battle. You know, the Mahabharata, it's the Gita, it's a battle. We have many different voices within us, and some of them are not going to go down quietly. We're going to have to hold our ground, just as I was saying about your intuition, we're going to have to hold our ground and sometimes feel like we're doing violence to our own self. But we have to focus on where we're going. We have to transcend other pulls. And don't think this is a walk in the park. I mean, there's no story of spiritual growth that's just, oh, and then we just decided to be spiritual and we just went and had a picnic and then pretty soon there we were. You know, it's everything is an epic struggle because we're deeply committed to wrong attitudes and they won't go down easily. We have to fight hard against them. Which brings me to the eight manifestations. Shall I do it?
Yes.
Okay. But this was important. The eight manifestations are one of the most useful spiritual principles, you know, just like relating to every reality on its own level, being appropriate. I mean, there's a few things that are just write them on your wall and just look at them every day. Being appropriate, learning to behave, Sri Yukteswar said, relating to every level of reality in an appropriate manner. The eight manifestations of God are the way that the wonderful principles of Sanatana Dharma explain this without making it so personal. God is an experience. God is Satchitanandam. He's not a person that we get to know. His pure consciousness, pure Satchitanandam, can flow through individuals, but they have no ego. There's no person there. It's just a body through which we can feel Satchitanandam. So they say that God manifests in these eight ways: love, peace, joy, calmness, wisdom, power, which is sometimes easier to understand if you think energy, light, and sound. And what it means to be in tune with the divine is to be in tune with the manifestations of the divine. Because there's no, what else would you be in tune with? There's no personality that we please. Yogananda talks in The Whispers from Eternity about this completely barbaric way that we approach prayer and God, which is all based, he said, on the serf-king relationship. Because a lot of the biblical images came out of the serf-king reality, where you have the all-powerful king, and then you have the little serfs hoping, you know, that he's going to give you something. And even when the masters would come and try to get you to understand, they would have to talk in the language of the times. But that just makes us helpless in the face of this force. And that's what Jesus tried to correct when Jesus said, God is your father. If you ask your father for a loaf of bread, will he give you a stone? Because the Old Testament image of God was such a serf king image. And, you know, the Old Testament's just full of God smiting this one and smiting that one and smashing this one and destroying that one. I mean, it's just a vicious book.
And the religious, they took Jesus' imagery and made it all about kings and lords
all over again. All over again. But he tried to make it about fathers and sons. He was trying to get us more intimate. And Yogananda's trying to make it about the Divine Mother. Jesus could only take it from the judge to the father, but Yogananda could take it all the way to the mother. You see, it gets more intimate each time we go through it. But that's because the human mind needs a way to personify this, and the human heart, these are, it's a symbol, but it's a symbol that awakens a truth. So it isn't as if, as certain sects teach, that there's really a heavenly mother up there wearing an apron, you know, fixing us heavenly pancakes, and heavenly father comes in. And I mean, there's some theologies that are so literal that they're just ludicrous. You don't know how any person could follow them, but they do. It's nothing like that. But there is, but if we think of God as our divine mother, what that activates within us, you see, it activates an understanding. What does motherly love feel like? You know, what would it be like to have a perfect mother, to always have someone be compassionate and taking care of me, and someone I could completely trust who was always on my side? You see, it conjures up all these images which put us in tune with the actual manifestations of God. Love is an example. Yes, then I'll go back to
that. Doesn't Swami also talk about, I thought he talked about not necessarily higher way, but as God as our friend?
Yes. See, we pray, Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend. See, unfortunately, and I can never figure out how to articulate it, it comes out friend, beloved. Yeah, you have to have the comments. But you're actually talking about relationships. According to the Hindu tradition, the relationships you can have with the divine are God is father, God is mother, God is friend, God is beloved. That's the Radha Krishna story, where there's Krishna who's the Lord and Radha is his sweetheart. You know, romantic love. Yeah, and friend is Arjuna and Krishna were friends. They were the same age, and they were companions on the battlefield, and they were fighting this war together, and they were cousins. Their relationship was primarily friend to friend. And so there's father, mother, friend, beloved, the master and the servant, and then the child. That you can have God as your child, which is one that the West doesn't get, except at Christmas. At Christmas, we play out God is the baby. And it's self-evident, if you think about it, how fabulously heart-opening that is, isn't it? The whole spirit of Christmas is defined by the fact that Jesus is a little baby. And whenever you're near little babies, I mean, what happens to us when we're near little babies? Oh, look at the little baby, you know? It's like all sense of self-concern goes away. The heart immediately opens. This wonderful sweetness comes. And then we begin to manifest these qualities. And so these are tools that we use to get us to those realities. But this is the actual manifestation. Those are symbols that move us out, that are, they're like one thorn to take out another thorn, so to speak. It opens the heart. It gets you in the right mood. It puts you in tune. Once you're deeply in tune, you realize that it was just a symbol. But to say back here, oh, it's just a symbol, and then just sit in our tight little hard ego because we're, you know, we're only interested in the final one, we're not going to do this, then we just get to be lumpy and unhappy for longer. Yes?
I have another. I'm sorry.
That's right.
You guys know everything, but I don't. So
you're asking good questions, though. So it's good.
Another question that comes to mind.
Sure.
Why throughout the years, I don't know if like in any of the teachings that you have read, why throughout the times it looks like, you know, for whatever reason, God always decides to send, you know, a master, you know, a guider, to guide, you know, like us who are in this field that you're talking about. Why, I mean, there is any explanation why he has never been sent a master in the body of a woman?
I've asked Swamiji that. There's many. His answer was this. The concept of masculine and feminine is a divine reality. There are men and women because there's masculine and feminine. So the male body and the female body is a manifestation of the fact that there is duality in the universe, that the one became two. If you have the one reality, this is Satchidanandam, and creation is made by that one reality vibrating and giving the appearance of many. I mean, you know, just as I start moving my hand like that, it looks like there's more than one happening, but there's really only one. If you see the blade of a fan spinning, it creates this whole seeming reality, but it's really only the movement that's creating the seeming reality. So if you have one at one point and you begin to move, you go opposites. And when those opposites resolve, they come back to the one. So everything in creation is dual. There's morning and night, there's youth and age, there's sickness and health, there's male and female. When I talk about it, I like to talk about male and female as yin and yang, because people know you have the circle, you have the two Paisleys that interlock, and you don't. There's nothing pejorative about either being yin or yang. There's all the gender politics that gets involved when you talk about men and women, but let's just say yin and yang. The whole circle is created by the interplay of yin and yang, because for anything to happen, you have to have the active and the receptive. They're just, these are the two dimensions, the positive and negative, meaning not favorable or unfavorable, but just they balance each other out. Now, yin, yang, the masculine yang, has certain characteristics. It's outgoing, it moves the material world, it creates, it thinks in terms of power and making things happen. It's a manifestation. It has, you know, it has that kind of yang energy, exerts a force on the world. That's why traditionally those who are in male bodies have yang energy and they go out and conquer the world. Traditionally, the yin energy is the nurturing energy that keeps the home fires burning. Now, whether or not, you know, you have a man and a woman playing the yin and the yang roles, whether you have two men, two women, or whatever, or the woman being the yang and the male being the yin, for life to work nicely, all of these things are needed. Too much yang energy is way out of balance. Too much yin energy is way out of balance. So that's the first premise of it. At this time in our society, the manifestation of yin and yang is not as predictable by the gender of the body as it has been in other periods of time, because we're in a changing time. So we have very yang women and we have very yin men, and we have, basically we have a big mess is what we really have, but because nobody quite knows how to behave right now. But the end result of it will be, because each of us is the complete yin-yang within ourself, and we generally incarnate in a body as a starting point, the influence of that body is the appropriate karmic influence, and then we have to work our way through coming to the whole of it. The simple reason, Kriyananda said when I asked him why the avatars historically have all been men, is it's a yang job. because the nature of an avatar is that he comes and he moves. He moves the world. He creates a mission. He makes it happen. And that's yang work. And so you would choose the body that is predisposed in a yang direction. I mean, just even the way the genitals are made, it's a yang energy. And if you come into a yin body, why would you come into a yin body to do yang work? And great saints like Ananda Mema, for example, who was a very great saint, she's in Autobiography of a Yogi, she's called the Joy Permeated Mother. She never did anything. She just sat there from young age. Until old age, she just sat there. She inspired tens, hundreds of thousands of people around the world. She never founded an organization. She never wrote a book. She never did anything. She just sat there. Total, perfect yin. But internally, she was very balanced. Her philosophy, Kriyananda knew her well. Her philosophy was very impersonal, very powerful, very cutting through all of the, you know, she was much more yang in the way she expressed her belief than Yogananda was, but her mission was entirely feminine. She just nurtured, and they called her Ma, they called her Mother. And it was just the way it was meant to be. So it's unlikely that an avatar would take a female body, but maybe in some future time they will, but that doesn't mean there haven't been and aren't enormously powerful saints. But most of the saints who are in female bodies, there's something essentially feminine about the way they work, even though in themselves they're going to be perfectly balanced. They would have to be. Just as Yogananda, whom that picture doesn't look like it, but many people see his picture and think he's a woman. And in fact, there's a story that was told when he was wearing his hair long and he was on a train. I think he was on a train, sitting on the train, and there was the conductor walking back and forth and kept looking, and finally he couldn't contain himself with the conductor, who was somewhat uneducated, said to him, "Is you a man or is you a woman?" He just couldn't tell. because his vibration was so like that. In fact, there's a story also told when Yogananda was invited to dinner at the home of friends of his, and he was sitting at the table, and there was a child, and the child kept edging closer and closer to Master, finally standing right by, and then just got really close and said, "Are you a man or a woman?" Because the child kept feeling the vibrations, and he couldn't identify the vibrations. You know, most people are so influenced by the body they're in, you can tell who they are. But this child, being a little disconnected from it, plus his long hair, she just couldn't tell whether he was a man or a woman. He said, "What do you think?"
So, then these, all these avatars seems like they are so, highly conscious. Their yin and yang energies are, I suppose, to be perfectly
balanced.
But for, our times, I would say a male, impersonation will work out. Well, because I think, an avatar that would have a woman,
woman's body,
it would have the same kind of perfect balance of yin and yang as what a male avatar would have.
Right.
So for whatever reason,
it's just there
to have the male kind of a.
I don't think it's better or worse. I think you have to reason backwards from the fact that when they've all had a choice and they've all taken male bodies.
Yeah.
As a rule, society, speaking of society, they have more freedom as men. I think the main reason is it's because it's a yang job. And if they want to do a yin job, they come in differently. That's me really saying that.
Yeah.
And it may be that in future ages where it's just a different reality. But the yin and yang, is the foundation of men and women. So you would always see that that role would be a yang reality, and that the person who would take it would want to have a masculine thrust of energy.
No, I ask that question because what I have experienced is you females, and it's not because you are here, it's you keep our bots in many ways as a strong. Their strength that women have in comparison with men is much higher when it comes inner power. We're crying babies. We have anything, and you suffer whatever, and you suck it in, okay? we freak out, okay?
I don't accept that, but I'll listen to it.
Well, what I have seen, the women I have, around with, and that is, for me, is amazing, because I'm the biggest crying baby. And I see the women enduring much more pain with ease.
I think both sides, I think yin and yang has to come into perfect balance. That's basically what I've observed. And everybody, until we're liberated, until we're completely free, we're working out that perfect balance. And I think that both sides, you're right. I mean, there's a lot to be admired about both men and women. This Swami always talks about it. He said, you have a coin and it has two sides. And the coin has a certain value. He said, how can you say that one side of the coin has more value than the other side of the coin? And he said, that's exactly what we're working with. We have the masculine and feminine, male and female, yin and yang, men and women, whatever you call it. It's two sides of one coin. And ultimately, we have to have both sides within us. We have this polarity because it's instructive. But eventually, we have to come both sides. And you look at the yin side, and you see all these wonderful qualities. And see, that's the appropriate response. Wherever we're standing, we obviously need to come into balance. So if we see manifested, in your case, you're saying, I see in women these qualities that are extremely admirable, that's your teaching. I mean, that you're being taught. You're excessively one direction, and you're seeing the beauty of going another direction, and the hope is that you'll move toward it. And if it's personified in your mind by women have this strength and men don't, and I really admire that, then the goal is for you to move closer to it. Not just admire it or to rely on her to give it, but just to move toward the center. Eventually everything comes to androgyny. In my own relationship with my husband, David, what I enjoy about it, partly because we don't have children, but above all, it's because of who we both are. It's sort of like we just take turns playing the yin and yang roles, just depending. And I've observed that most relationships have a tendency to go off. Our relationship, we become too yang. We both become very outwardly focused. And we live more balanced now, but there's been times in our lives where it's just like, you know, you look around and once David had hung in his closet a shirt that was dirty that he couldn't wear. I said, honey, why did you hang it back in your closet? He said, well, at least then I can see it. He said, if I put it in the laundry, I'll never see it again. I mean, laundry is my responsibility, you know. So I looked at this, you know, pile like this. And sometimes we would both feel just like things weren't happening properly. And you'd look and you see the laundry had piled up and there was no food in the refrigerator. And, you know, just the house was a mess. But for us, what we would do is basically whoever had the capacity at the moment to turn yin would just go yin. And we'd just, like, pull the thing back into balance. And then we'd go on again. And, you know, I've seen other relationships where it gets too yin. You know, everybody's just hunkering at home and nobody can figure out what to do. You know, somebody has to make a foray into the outside world. Whether it's the man or the woman, it doesn't matter. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't have a question.
Okay. I'm going to go back to this because I don't feel like I finished it. Okay, this little picture here, from the point of view of attunement, which is the underlying theme of what we're talking about, if you want to be in tune, the way you be in tune is you always observe which one of these am I able to manifest at this time, and let me manifest it as much as I can. The man who was doing his physics problem, he was manifesting a lot of light, he was a lot of energy, a lot of wisdom, a lot of love for his work, a lot of joy in what he was doing. The fact that his concentration happened to be drawn out of him because it was physics, in his particular case, for a whole lot of other reasons, but what he was really manifesting was these divine qualities through his practice of physics. So you could be a street sweeper, you could be a college professor, you could be an opera singer, you could be a store clerk, you could be any number of things, but what you're actually doing is you are manifesting or not manifesting one of these eight qualities of the divine. And what I also find useful about these is that sometimes one or the other is much more accessible to you. Okay, I'm going to also point out that we have two here, peace and calmness. Peace is the absence of strife. You know, you can be in a state of peace because you're in harmony with yourself. Everything is in order, and there's just a wonderful sense of peace to the reality. You can be in the middle of a war. You can be on a battlefield with a gun in your hand, and there's not a bit of peace. There's not much love. There may not be much joy about it, but you can be very, very calm. So calmness and peace are two very distinct qualities, and sometimes you are in the middle of a battlefield, and sometimes, let's just say, you are a soldier and you are in war, and you have a cause that you have to fight for, if wisdom has brought you to the understanding that you have to fight for it, whatever the reasons are, you may not be able to do anything else, but you can be very calm about it. There's just no point in becoming hysterical, upset, and you're not at peace and you're not happy, but you're very calm. You just do your job and that's what you have to do. And so if you look at your life, in every circumstance, you can always find one of these that will work. Energy is a very important one to me. I prefer the word energy to power, but it's described as power. Because sometimes I'm just in a mood. I'm just not interested in doing anything useful. But at least I'll put out some energy. So maybe I will do the ironing, or I'll do the laundry, or I'll get on my bicycle and I'll just take a ride. Or I'll go to the gym and I'll go swimming. You know, I can just put out energy, because the alternative to that would be just to lie on the bed and turn on the television or go to sleep when I'm not really sleepy, or to go and have a great big meal that I don't need. And that doesn't seem like a really good manifestation, because I don't find overeating, oversleeping anywhere here. But I'm not really, you know, very joyful. But if I go put out energy, I use my wisdom to figure out that the only thing I can do is put out energy. And if I just start putting out energy, then all of a sudden you see I'm back in tune. I'm back in tune with one of the manifestations of spirit. And once I start putting out energy, I begin to feel a little happier. And when I feel a little happier, then maybe I begin to be interested in doing something I want to be, I love, I'm attracted to doing something I really ought to do. The light and sound are interesting here. Sound is the power of Om in its, you know, complete form. It's the Om vibration. But sound is also a constant part of our reality, not the least of which is the sound of your own voice. A lot of times, when things begin to go wrong in your life, listen to the sound of your voice. Because often the sound you are putting out is not a manifestation of spirit. And the first thing that you can actually do is change the sound of your voice. When I was trying to overcome a very bad karmic habit of mine, which was to get a little upset, sort of certain things would set me off and I would get very anxious. And I began to realize that whenever that vritti was being activated within me, my voice would get higher and higher in pitch and faster and faster. Why do you not think we ought to do that? Because I didn't, you know, and I began to realize as soon as I heard that sound, it didn't make any difference what I was saying or how right I might be or how justified, even if I was, which I usually wasn't. As soon as I heard that sound was not the right manifestation of spirit. And I would just silence myself. I mean, just like that. And then I would find if I modulated the sound of my own voice, the act of modulating the sound of my voice would also affect my thoughts. I couldn't have those hysterical thoughts without the hysterical voice. It's very interesting. Plus, of course, then you can think of sound, like what music am I listening to? You know, what kind of noise is going on around me? What kind of atmosphere am I living in? Just all those different ways that sound manifests. Light is also interesting because light, of course, is above all the spiritual eye, and in the beginning was the light. The beginning was the word, which was the sound. God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And light is the foundation of all of creation. That's what creates. That's the constant, is light. But light also means lighthearted, lighter in tone. So again, you can find yourself in all the meanings of the word light, being dark, being heavy, and so you can lighten up. You can read a funny story. You can tell a joke. You can think more lightly. You can straighten your spine. You can go out in the sunshine. So, and all of these are when I find myself feeling out of tune, which is to say, not being one of these, then begin to manifest it. And your question, how during the day do I stay in tune? You stay in tune by always being a channel for one or more of these qualities. And that's the practical, actual way it's expressed. You can't walk around with a Yogananda mask on your head, you know, trying to be him. It was humorous. Years ago, there was an Indian teacher who had a thick accent, and his disciples would imitate his Bengali accent. And it was just like, give me a break. You know, you're not going to be more in tune by speaking English that isn't even your own style. This is what you have to manifest, because this is what the masters manifest perfectly. And you read the story of the masters' lives and you put this template on it, that's what you see. Jesus is in front of Pontius Pilate and there's a drunken crowd of people who've been, you know, instigated to demand his crucifixion, and he's standing there and he's been humiliated like this, and Pontius Pilate is pleading with him. You know, I do not want to crucify you. Basically, help me let you go. Jesus just stands there. First of all, Jesus won't even answer. Then he says, even now, you know, I could call down legions of angels. You have no power over me. I mean, that was power. That was calmness. You know, it perhaps wasn't the most loving thing he could have said, but he was being what he was supposed to be, right in the middle of that. And you read all the lives of the masters and you see this is what they've done. They've constantly manifested these qualities. That's how you be like them. That's the reality behind it. Okay? And so solve all your problems this way. Don't get really big and complicated in your mind. Just look at what you're doing, and if you're off, figure out which one you can do. Calm down if necessary. Cheer up if necessary. Be kinder if necessary. Or go out on your bicycle.
So would it be safe to say then that these are without opposite and they're pure and they're the center of the chakras?
Well, they have opposites. The opposite of peace is war. The opposite of joy is sadness. But when you are manifesting these qualities, the degree to which they have opposites is the degree to which your ego identified, and therefore you're going to pull the opposite out of it. But these are the doorways through which you transcend those identities. Because this is the war you're fighting. The war you're fighting is the ego is always wanting to pull you away, and the Kauravas and the Pandavas within you, the two positive and negative forces, the forces of toward material reality, the force toward spiritual growth, just keep following these signs. And then what happens is the divine energy, the grace of God or the grace of Guru, comes down and it greases the wheels.
And that's when you do the chakra class, mm-hmm. and you talk about the flow.
Right.
And the flow.
This is the flow. This is the flow. Right. Okay, this is the flow. These are the qualities that increase the flow. Okay? Yeah. Fair enough. Yes, you put it together well. That's good. All right. Any other questions or thoughts? We're getting toward the end of the cycle. Carol asked me the question about the children. Carol teaches children, and she was asking me, how much do children know? You know, when Yogananda incarnated, he talks in Autobiography of a Yogi about being a baby in the crib and gradually making sense out of the voices that he heard all these languages in his mind. He saw all these images in his mind, all these different places. And then gradually, by the repetition of what was going on around him, he perceived that these people were speaking Bengali, that this one was his mother, this one was his father, that just it gradually came to him where he was and what he was doing. And he began to relate to that reality. I think he was saying all that because he was giving us the possibility of what a baby's consciousness could be. He even says, parents think that the baby's consciousness is limited to toys and toes, but in fact, the baby's consciousness can be in many places. Swami Kriyananda describes in his autobiography about his earliest memories are of a certain kind of joy that had nothing to do with where he was. That, in fact, everything around him seemed to be just sort of a dim reflection of what he was really experiencing. In fact, until he was almost 9, as he put it, he never really entered this world. He was really more simultaneously conscious of the astral world. And only when he became an older child did he realize he had to relate to this world. And he began to deliberately close down. He said he used to fall asleep at night until the age of 9. When he closed his eyes, he would see a great light in front of him, and that light would gradually expand until he merged into it. That's how he would go to sleep. He thought everyone went to sleep that way. But when he was 9, the demands of this incarnation began to assert themselves. And he said he became ill with a fever, and he was delirious, and then the delirium and that light began to be mixed up in his mind. But the real thing was he realized he had to relate to this life, and he started trying to relate to this world in a way he hadn't bothered to try before. And then all the trials began for him which didn't end until he met Yogananda. Then interestingly, he said, after he learned to meditate, he went back into the state of consciousness, the superconscious state that he'd known as a child. And as soon as he entered it, the most interesting thing, he said, it was the same moment, because there's no time in that state of consciousness. A fascinating glimpse. Now, children's awareness depends entirely on how expanded their consciousness is. Most children are not entirely connected with this world yet, because they're just like Yogananda. They have a whole mess of past life memories just all happening. And some of them, like, you see some babies. There was this little girl here. She looked like an old woman for about 3 years. And about the age of 3, she finally began to have a child's face. Up until that time, she just looked like an old woman, and she looked so petulant and confused all the time. It was like, what am I doing here? Where are the servants? Why am I so small? Why can't I function? Why are they asking me to do these demeaning, ridiculous things? I mean, she just had that whole look to her, until gradually, just by sheer repetition or acceptance, she let go of that and came more into this reality and started being more like a child. Some children are, a friend of mine, a young man, he has his own son now, but he was never a baby. Even just as a little person, he just had the demeanor and the qualities of an old man. Not old man, but of a full-grown man. He was a baby. Swami Kriyananda said he was always like that. He said adults found him a little disconcerting because he never saw himself as a child. He just saw himself as a person. And he said he had a disconcerting way of treating adults like equals, and they didn't quite know what to do about it. Because he just never accepted. He didn't identify sufficiently with the age of his body. Of course, he was a child, and he was a happy child, but he just never really identified with it. So behind his consciousness, there was always this mature understanding, even though it was acting through a child's body. Now, you also have to understand, children are not innocent. If you're a murderer who's executed with a lethal injection, you're a murderer. You're born with those same inclinations unless you've reformed. But there's a kind of hiatus. Childhood is a little bit of a vacation where the ego force is not quite so strong. Master says the ego force really kicks in at the age of 12 when puberty comes. Those first 12 years often are kind of a little bit of a holiday, which is why sometimes the child and the adult are so different. And at the age of 12, the rebelliousness and the independence and the insistence on their own way can just set in very suddenly. Because suddenly the child, the consciousness is identified with this incarnation, whereas before it was just living through it. And one of the things Nittai teaches about helping small children especially is to recognize that they do not identify with their behavior. Their behavior happens, but they feel themselves to be, to a very large extent, separate from it. So he said, if you tell a child that they're a bad person because they did a bad thing, it's not merely that it hurts their self-esteem, it completely bewilders them. A bad thing was done, but they haven't identified with it in the same way. So he teaches we should always relate to the bad thing that was done. And then the child and the teacher work together over the bad thing that was done, but we never make the mistake of identifying the child with it because the child himself doesn't see it that way. An adult person has identified and is responsible in a different manner.
Is there sort of a veil that would keep a child from remembering, like language or all the stuff we have to go over,
well,
all over again?
Master says, for reasons that we don't understand, that we have to forget all those things. Think about it. Think about how heavy the traumas are that you can remember. Imagine if you remembered every lifetime. You know, that veil of forgetfulness comes down, really just to give us a fresh start. Otherwise, we'd be weighted down from birth. I mean, think how weighted down so many people are by the end of their lives. Man, if you had to carry that over the next time, and the next time, and the next time, and the next time. But then you have the things that break through. My nephew, when he was a very young child, he could just sit down and play the piano. In fact, he never could learn to play because he played so well, he could never learn. I mean, I remember sitting when he was 7, he was just improvising beautiful music. It wasn't that he was playing well for a 7-year-old. He was playing beautiful music. I don't know. He didn't know either. It was just in his hands. He just knew where it was. And he's not the only one. And many people are talented from a very young age. Or Cindy, who was the ballet dancer here, she started dancing at 3. You know, devoted her entire life to ballet. She started at 3. It was just, she was born, she was ready, she was going to start.
Children have, there's this consciousness. They have this consciousness that they don't forget, right?
Consciousness of what? They don't necessarily explicitly remember
it.
But they're the sum total of what they are, relating appropriately to a baby's body.
Like if I died right now and I come back, I would.
You would
not
be
remember
your,
how to talk. Or
no, you wouldn't, because. Because how to
I
talk
would
is.
Be me.
You would be me, essentially, in a baby form.
And yeah. I could. But I wouldn't have thoughts, or I wouldn't. I mean, it's just like sometimes babies look at me like I'm looking at them, wondering what they're knowing. And they just...
Swami says, to a very large extent, childhood is play acting. That's how he put it. He said the soul plays at being a child. He said, look, if some tragedy strikes and the 4-year-old has to take care of the 2-year-old, it's amazing how adult they suddenly become. He said a lot of childhood is play acting. It's just like, here I am, I'm just going to be a baby, let me just enjoy it. Or hate it. Sometimes they hate it. I remember a friend of mine, his son, whom I just met as an 18-year-old, who's still a gorgeous man. He's now a gorgeous man. He was a gorgeous baby, had a very unusual consciousness as a baby, and I saw him having his diapers changed one day. I just walked in. His mother was changing his diapers. I may have been projecting this, but I think it was true. The diapers being changed. The child has his head pulled as far away from the project as he can, And he's just sort of gazing off like this, and he has this look on his face like, I can't believe this is happening. It was just like, it was so undignified, he could just hardly stand it. One woman told me about her child. Her child would never poop in her diaper. She just wouldn't do it. And they finally figured that out, and they just held the little baby over a toilet. And even she would say, I promise, I'll change you right away. She just, it was just too gross. She just wouldn't do it. I mean, she would get terrible stomach cramps. I mean, this was like, they figured all this out. She would get terrible stomach cramps because she just, pooping in a diaper was just, she wasn't going to do it. And when they finally figured that out, then her life got a lot easier. She would poop, but not in the diaper, no way.
When the kids in my class go home, they ask me for whether they want a hug, a shake, or a bump in the head.
Uh-huh.
So they tell me what they want, and that's how we say goodbye. But one day, like a couple weeks ago, this one little boy, he goes like this.
Really, isn't that fun?
And so now several of them are doing it, and some of them are going, what are they doing?
Yeah, who knows where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Right. But if this had been the habitual gesture of...
Yeah, so I just do that back to them.
Yeah, and you know, it's... You go to some countries and you're so at home there. I mean, I was so at home in India. It just felt... Everything about India feels right to me. Not the physical reality, it's a mess. But everything about that culture feels right to me. And it was such a relief. Very little about this culture feels right to me. But I like the energy, the cleanliness, the enthusiasm, the optimism. There's, you know, it's a much better place to do spiritual work, but... Well, is that about the end of the story? I think that's the end of the story. Thank you all very much. This was recorded, and they have the capacity to make CDs for you. Not immediately, but eventually.